Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are, and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. It actually wasn't until the middle of this week's interview that it struck me how much I talked about in The Obstacle is the Way, overcoming impediments, but specifically what you would call speech impediments. I talk about Thomas Jefferson, about how Thomas Jefferson's discomfort speaking aloud into audiences channeled that energy into being a great writer. Talk about Demosthenes and his famous stutter, which led him to he literally goes underground. He shaves his head. He doesn't show his face in public for years as he not only gets over the stutter, but makes himself one of the great speakers and orators of not just his time, but all time. And that made for a very fruitful conversation with today's guest, John Hendrickson, whose work at The Atlantic I've read for many, many years. He wrote this fascinating piece about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's lifelong battle with and eventually over his stutter, which was an epic long read back in 2019. Absolutely should read it. John is also the author of a fantastic new book, Life on Delay, Making Peace with a Stutter. My dear friend Austin Kleon recommended that I talk with John. He said he's having a new book. I think you would like it. Check it out. And I cracked open this book. And as you'll see in today's episode, the epigraph was quite familiar to me and I think will be familiar to many of you. John lives in New York City. Before he wrote for The Atlantic, he wrote and edited for Rolling Stone, for Esquire, and the Denver Post. And so John has a stutter. It's a fact of his life. It's also an impediment to things that a lot of us just take totally for granted, right? There's a fascinating video we talk about in the thing. There's a video of him trying to make a customer service call, and they go please say your name at the tone. And he goes to say it and it says, sorry, I can't hear you. Or please, it's this fascinating thing. He's trying to use this automated call service thing. And this thing that would ordinarily be so easy for most of us is super hard for him. And you can see his frustration. You can see him having to practice a kind of stoicism of not getting upset, not feeling insecure, not throwing up his hands and quitting. This thing that should take 2 seconds instead is extraordinarily difficult. And you could also imagine it made communicating over a virtual podcasting host harder, right? There's already sometimes a lag from technology. Sometimes it can be harder to hear someone that the equipment doesn't always work. And so it was interesting to even think about it was interesting to catch myself thinking about something that I wouldn't have thought about if I was having any other guest on. And that was actually something as we wrapped up the interview, I talked to him about. Also, I said, hey, obviously you want people to listen to this and we want the experience to be as good as possible for the interview. How do you want this to be edited, right? When we do these podcasts, I have an editor come back in and get rid of unnecessary ums and uhs or breaks or, weird digressions sometimes. Or if somebody says, no, wait, what I mean is, sometimes we get rid of that. I had to ask John, what he thought about that. Does he want me to get rid of some of the pauses before he starts talking, or is it important that it's there? And he said to leave it to me. So what you hear here is a slightly cleaned up version, but I think the experience of hearing what I heard is important. So you'll listen to that in this interview. But I was just so excited to do this interview. And in the book, John writes about bullying and substance abuse, depression, isolation, things that people with stutters are prone to, they deal with. It talks about the family dynamics that go into, you know, how one's parents know how to deal with a thing like this. And do they do a good job? Or, you know, we get a sense of his childhood in the book, his career as a journalist, and even his search for love. It's, as I said, just a beautiful book. And then there's a lot of discussions of the science and the evolving understanding of speech impediments in the book, which I was fascinated to learn about. So I'll just get into the interview. Check out John's new book, Life on Delay, Making Peace with a Stutter. You can follow him on Instagram and Twitter at John G. Hendy. So that's John, the letter G, H-E-N-D-Y. And I think you're really going to like this conversation. I felt very inspired and edified after having it. And I think you're going to like listening to it. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Well, thank you for doing this. I'm excited. And I was excited to talk before I'd actually read the book. And then I opened it up and I read the epigraph, which is a quote I like so much, I wrote an entire book about it. The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes a way. That's Marx Aurelius. Tell me what that means to you in relation to your life and why you opened the book with that.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me on. I'm a big fan. And your work has meant a lot to me because social media in particular is just the most anxiety-inducing, confidence-breaking thing out there. And when I follow your page or pages like Ram Dass, I get the opposite. And I get messages like that in the epigraph. And so I knew I wanted to put a message of that nature right at the top of the book. What I love about that quote is it's paradoxical. It doesn't seem like it makes sense, and yet it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I think as I've come to understand that quote, it's not just that. I think like a very simple reading is that like, there's the thing you think is bad is actually, there's a silver lining to it, right? Or that like you can turn everything around. And I think that that's partly true, but I have been thinking about it more and more as the idea of like, whatever you happen to experience in life, it's an opportunity to be excellent in whatever capacity one is able to be excellent. So even, you know, that it's always an opportunity to practice a virtue or virtue, even if that virtue is like the exact opposite of what one would like to be practicing, be it patience or forgiveness or, you know, returning love when one is hated, you know, on down the line. It's not this like, hey, everything is good, but it's that there is an opportunity to be good inside really, really bad things.
Exactly. And I think it also gives you purpose. You know, so many people are just looking for a purpose. And the wisdom of that quote is this thing that's literally holding you back may give you purpose in life. And it took me a really long time to come to that perspective. And I, you know, there's a part of my brain that is telling me the opposite of that message. And I'm kind of at war trying to let the positive self-talk beat the negative self-talk. And I think that's a daily active practice.
Well, yeah, because I imagine it's relatively simple to say the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. But in your case, it's not only not literally simple to say it, but like it's where the rubber meets the road on these ideas, where one has to take the worst or the hardest or the most frustrating or the most unfair thing in their life and find a way to demonstrate excellence inside of it. Like that's where it stops being philosophy and it starts being like a real huge problem.
Yeah. And it's easy to be high-minded and theoretical with this, but it's like, no, I actually have an impediment to me procuring a cup of coffee in the morning or to me ordering a pizza. These like little tiny moments that make up the fabric of life. When you're a person who stutters or a person with any number of other disabilities, those tiny moments really are challenging. And if you make enough compromises and if you find yourself withdrawing and avoiding those moments out of trying to avoid momentary embarrassment, you just start doing that over and over and over again. And then you realize, wow, I'm missing out on a lot of life. I'm living a really small life. And part of this book is me trying to figure out just like how to get my life back.
Yeah, I watched that New York Times video that you did, and it was showing you trying to like talk to an automated message, like on a customer service line or something. And it was really illustrative to me because I think everyone could go, yeah, it would be difficult to have a stutter, but you don't quite think about the ways in which the entire world is designed around the implicit assumption that you should easily be able to do this thing. And I imagine that's true for all sorts of different disabilities or whatever the term people want to use. But like when, you know, the other term, microaggression, right? Like the idea of an implicit or a systemic slight against someone, you know, you're sort of waking up and dealing with that all the time. That could be a recipe, not just for a withdrawn life, I imagine, but also a shameful life or also a very angry life. And those are choices that you have had to make.
Absolutely. And what I try to get across in this book is that actual stuttering, like my mouth just there, just a stutter, that is the very, 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 very tip of the iceberg as far as the problem. The rest of the problem is the internal daily battle, the mental health battle. And people who stutter are much more likely to deal with issues like depression, anxiety, OCD, substance abuse. And the way that we cope is not always great. I mean, there were years of my life where I avoided picking up the telephone and answering. There were years where I was too afraid to just order off a restaurant menu, let alone ask someone out on a date or try to apply for a job. And that's really what this book is about and what the layers of disability come down to. And that's a thing that I think people with disabilities know, but a lot of the population doesn't think about that part.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I talked about Demosthenes in The Obstacle is the Way, obviously one of the sort of more famous examples of a person with a speech impediment. But as you were saying that, I was just thinking about it. It's like, okay, so he has this speech impediment, which is one sort of problem. And if everything else in his life was perfect and easy, then perhaps that would have been a pretty surmountable thing. But then you go, no, then your parents die, so you withdraw a little bit. Then the people who are supposed to take care of you don't take care of you. Then they steal from you. Then, you know, the court system is rigged against you. So I was just thinking, it's like, yeah, this guy has to go on this journey to get what was taken from him. And then every step of the way, the impediment that he has or the hand that life has dealt him makes that already difficult and unfair thing that he's been sort of robbed blind by his legal guardians. It's like 1,000 times harder to deal with because he has to get up and give speeches about them in court to get them back. And just the way that these things kind of all overlap with each other, I never really thought about that until you said it.
Well, just to be clear for your listeners, you're describing Demosthenes there. You're not describing me. parents are alive.
Course.
Yeah,
of course.
People taking care of me. I've not gone to court. I just want to make sure everyone knows.
Yes.
That. Yeah. Yes. But that's exactly it. So, and that's a huge part of this book too. That like, it's not about the mechanics of the talking. It's not about one physical challenge. It's about how the struggle to communicate affects every fiber of your being. And that truth is something I totally suppressed and ignored for the first 3 decades of my life. And it's only a truth I've begun to grapple with in recent years as I set out to write this book.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book, and I guess I wasn't as familiar with how it works as well. That fundamentally we've come to understand it as a neurological disorder, not just some bad habit that someone has picked up that you can sort of bully them into not having, or you know, train them into not having with a few simple techniques. That this is a wiring issue that has a very prominent or public symptom, and for basically thousands of years we've been treating the symptom and kind of blaming the victim also.
Only since around the turn of the millennium have researchers and scientists understood this as a neurological disorder with a complex genetic component. It's not merely a manifestation of anxiety and nervousness. It's brain chemistry. And we're learning more and more with each passing year But that basic fact is something I only learned in 2019 when I wrote this article for The Atlantic about Joe Biden's lifelong journey with stuttering. And learning a lot of this new information about the disorder he and I both have, it rocked my world.
What is the realization that it is a neurological condition or a sort of a fact? How does that change your own perception? Because the majority of your life, you had a sort of a different paradigm for understanding what you were doing and what you were going through. And then suddenly it's presented to you in a different way. I mean, the underlying issue is still the same, right? But how it's just, the story, the lens through which you're seeing it changes, what does that mean for you?
I was always on an island with it. It was always my problem, my thing. And I certainly knew there were other people out there who stuttered, but I never really met them. And it never dawned on me to ever Google conferences for people who stutter, support groups for people who stutter. And those things certainly exist, and I've found them, but it was just this private, really personal failing. That's how I viewed it for a while. Sure. And it's taken a lot of work to break out of that mindset.
Does it allow you to accept it in a way that maybe you couldn't when there was some notion that it was your fault or that it was more solvable than, you know, perhaps it was?
Yes. Even learning that this is considered a disability, that reoriented my sense of self, because I never really ever sought disability accommodations. And I read about this in a chapter, but I nearly didn't graduate college because I was constantly avoiding taking a 100 level public speaking class. And wow. When I went back to interview some old teachers and professors in this book, one of them asked me, did you ever register with the disabilities office, you know, for undergraduate students? And I said, no, that thought never crossed my mind.
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think people sometimes think in Stoicism, this idea of resignation is to be avoided, or acceptance. It feels like, weirdly, acceptance feels like a form of passivity or cowardice or like a lack of agency. But I've come around to the idea that actually it's kind of the first step in asserting the agency. Are you familiar with the idea of the Stockdale paradox?
No, I'm not. What is it?
So the Stockdale paradox, he's the prisoner of war in Vietnam. He is, he'd been introduced actually in graduate school at Stanford to Epictetus. So Stoicism is a sort of guiding force. He's in this horrible camp. He's solitary confinement. He's tortured multiple times. But basically what emerges from this is this thing that becomes known as the Stockdale paradox, where he says, on the one hand, you have to unflinchingly accept the reality of your condition, right? Where you are, what's happened, how bad the odds are. And then he said, but I simultaneously held that I would survive and that I would turn this into something that in retrospect, I would not trade away. And so this kind of paradox, again, to go to the Marcus quote, where it's like, it is what it is. It can't be denied. It's a neurological condition. It's this, this, or this. And then simultaneously going, well, now that I've accepted that, I'm free to sort of do what it is possible to do with that thing.
I love that. And that underscores the origin of my subtitle, which is Making Peace with a Stutter.
Right.
And as you know, as an author, subtitles are very hard. And they're, I think most people hate their subtitles. The reason it was important to me to make that this subtitle was because I viewed that phrase as my North Star. Making peace with something is much different than curing something. It's much different than even overcoming something. To me, making peace, I kind of do think about battle or think about war. And at the end of a war, when both sides lay down arms, you know, a lot has been lost. A lot of hard things have happened, but eventually both sides lay down arms, and you kind of just go forward. And that's something I have been trying to do. And the two sides in this case are me and my negative self-talk, you know. And the only other thing I'll say about this concept is there's a person who stutters in the book who is a ER nurse named Roisin McManus. Over the summer, Roisin gave an amazing keynote address at a conference for people who stutter. And I'm paraphrasing her here, but what she said was, you don't have to be happy about it. It's okay to be, to, you know, get pissed off about it. It's okay to not like it, but you can learn to just ride with it in the passenger seat, or you know, in the motorcycle sidecar. Sure. And you're still moving forward. You're still going places, and it's just kind of alongside with you. And that's enough sometimes.
That's actually a very beautiful metaphor. The Stoics have one. They say we're like a dog tied to a cart. Right? This is their understanding of fate, or what they call the logos, sort of the rhythm of the universe. They're like, we're a dog tied to a cart. They're like, you can lay down and it'll drag you. Or, you know, you can trot happily alongside. It's sort of your call. And I think about that in relation to the things that we do not wish to be true, but unfortunately are true and are largely outside of our control. Our height, you know, what time in the world we're born, you know, what is happening in the world, you know, the individual, the things that DNA gives us, whether it's, you know, cancer or a stutter or, you know, a proclivity to do this or that, or to be addicted to this or that. These are sentences that have been handed down, and then we have to figure out how are we going to do that time.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, you say cancer there. There's a character in my book named Hunter Martinez, who was a lawyer who stutters. And he reached out to me after I wrote that Atlantic article, and he told me a bit of his life story. And it was this amazing email he sent me, and I thought, wow, what must it be like to be a lawyer who stutters? Someone who has to talk, someone who has to persuade people.
Right.
So I interviewed him, and I made him a main character. You know, we did many interviews over many months, and then we eventually got time together in person, really got to know him and his family. And during the course of us getting to know each other, he was diagnosed with colon cancer, and he was only 32. And our conversations quickly migrated from talking purely about stuttering to talking about his cancer journey. And he told me one of the most amazing things I've ever heard, which he said, being a person who stutters prepared me for cancer. Mm.
Why is that?
Because he had to just keep waking up every day and battling it and keep moving forward. And you have that fork in the road of you can either wallow, you know, you can get down on yourself, or you can just face it and square up and keep going, and you can make the most of what time you have left and be grateful for every day. And it's been hard because he did ultimately pass before this book was published. But I've kept in close touch with his widow, and we've had a lot of meaningful conversations in the year since he passed. And as I've dealt with such just peak anxiety, peak insecurity, peak self-doubt in the lead up to this book's publication, I have, you know, for lack of a better word, communed with him, and I've asked him to help me out, and I can hear him, I can feel him sending me messages back.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Yeah, you know, you brought up the sort of the war metaphor earlier, and you know, speaking of cancer in that regard, and then a battle with a stutter. It's like the thing about war is that nobody wins, right? Yes. Like, you know, even the person that wins still loses, right? It's a thing that takes a lot out of you. So there's an element of sort of tragicness to it, but again, I think the sort of the essence of Stoicism is like, how are you sort of great or good inside that kind of tragic, painful, unfair, situation. That's the part that you control.
Yes, exactly. And that sentence, being a person who stutters, preparing for cancer, I would never dream of comparing the two things. I would, you know, just as a person who does not have cancer at the moment, and I'm grateful for that, I would think that would be offensive if I wrote that sentence. If that sentence came from my brain, my mouth, I think it would be offensive. But to hear it come from a person battling colon cancer and hear them like elaborate on it and how they reach this perspective of just moving forward with positivity in the face of such adversity, it changed my life.
So I have two things that I want to get into. The first one is the idea of life on delay. That's the title of the book. And I was, you sort of talk about, you know, this sort of this pause, and you're saying one of the annoying things you end up hearing is people go, take your time, right? As you're struggling with it. But it did strike me that there is something about the delay or the pause or the forced consideration that must go into everything that you say, that I don't want to say it has an advantage, but I would say it does feel like the majority of us take for granted the ease with which we can say things and the simplicity and the effortlessness with which words pop out of our mouth. And that probably is to our detriment, not having the delay or the forced consciousness of what we're about to say and what we're going to have to pay to say it.
That's exactly right. So in a way, it can be kind of a blessing because it does give you that extra half second to put your words together. And when you're a person who stutters, you're so conscious of the amount of the time you take up in conversation, and you're so aware that the person you're talking to is like getting bored or uncomfortable and may leave the conversation any moment, and you're doing whatever you can to just be as efficient as possible with your word choices. And I think that made me a better writer because I'm just like pathologically averse to long sentences, long paragraphs, long chapters. I'm just always trying to keep the reader engaged.
Because God forbid someone makes you say one of them out loud.
Yeah, and like I, it's sort of. The way I view this is we have three voices. We have the voice in our head, we have the voice that we talk with, and we have the voice that we write with. And when you're a person who stutters, two of those voices are at war with each other. And for me, writing was the secret linchpin in which I could get things out the way they actually sounded in my head.
I suspect that's more common than maybe we might think it is. Like I've always felt, not at all to compare our situations, but I've always felt like if I was really good at saying what I was thinking, I almost certainly wouldn't have developed well as a writer, right? Like if me at 11 years old could perfectly articulate to my parents the emotions of being a teenager or of being their kid or any of the feelings that I had, I mean, I just would have done that and then gone back to watching TV or, you know, hanging out with my friends. It was that life seemed difficult to explain, or there was an ineffableness to it, and that one really had to sit down and think and take their time and translate it through the medium of the written word to get to the essence of what I was trying to say, I'm not sure I would have developed as a writer. And I imagine that process is something similar to you, your inability to communicate verbally as effortlessly as you would like, probably channels that energy in a different direction.
That's exactly right. Writing was always my balm, my oasis, my escape. English was always my best subject, my favorite subject. Reading, obviously. And you can't be a good writer if you're not a good reader. And I just can't even describe to you what reading and writing have given me. Whatever being a person who stutters has taken away from me, reading and writing have given me back tenfold.
Yeah, I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, there's not that many examples of really great speakers or orators who are great writers. I mean, Churchill is probably the exception that proves the rule. Although even he tended to write via dictation as opposed to by hand. But I do wonder if, like, what it conversely, I tend to see with athletes, the it's almost like the more brilliant you are as an athlete, the less articulate you are. I wonder if it's because all the energy went towards physical expression, and you never developed over here the way that you could.
Well, just to politely disagree with you on part of that.
Go for it.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is an incredible writer, and he's obviously one of the best basketball players of all time.
For sure.
But I know what you mean, and I think, you know, it kind of mystifies me if I ever come across a really great writer who is also a really great public speaker. I'm just like, how is that possible?
It's not fair. Well, it's like, you know, the great, you know, they say you've got a face for radio. It's like the people mm-hmm. who have the brilliant voice are rarely as photogenic as one might hope. I think that is one thing we learn in life, is that nobody's the complete package. Mm-hmm. Nobody is the complete package. And that often, though, our deficiencies in one area force us to compensate in other areas. And that if we were perhaps more evenly balanced, you know, we wouldn't be able to do the things that we end up being able to do.
And that's one of these weird upsides of being a person who stutters, or I think being a person with any number of disabilities, is you are kind of always walking around naked. And you get embarrassed and you get in uncomfortable situations literally every day of your life, to right. the point where it does eventually get easier. And you're just, you know, I'm 34 and there's nothing anyone could say to me now as an adult man that's any worse or more painful than taunts I heard on the playground as a kid.
Yeah, I imagine you have a sort of a thick skin from it, but you also have just sort of a plodding sense of, like, I have to get through what I'm going to have to get through. Perhaps this isn't going to be pleasant, perhaps this is going to be mortifying. Perhaps this is going to be, deeply uncomfortable and awkward. You know, all the things that you end up dreading that in some ways are true, you probably have a sense of your own ability to endure things that other people would probably just be like, I'm out.
One of the things I explore in this book is that concept of building up rhino skin, we call it.
Yeah.
Just like so tough that whatever happens rolls off your back. And I think part of that idea is real and true. But what I eventually learned about myself was that not everything was rolling off my back. And actually, a lot of it, I was just pushing deep, deep, deep down inside of me and putting it in a locked box at the pit of my stomach. And as I kept getting older, that box kept getting bigger and heavier. And I reached a point where I was around the age of 30, in which I was feeling as though I was about to have a nervous breakdown. And I finally buckled down and went to psychotherapy, and that changed the course of my life.
Is that how you started processing this sort of baggage or pain that you'd been carrying around or pretending wasn't there?
Exactly. And that I think in some cases I didn't even know was there.
Sure.
But once you open it, it's the tired metaphor, but Pandora's box. And you can't go back, and all you can do is begin to make peace with it. And it's very empowering just talking to a person and getting these things out there. And the more you talk about it, the less power it has over you. And it does ultimately become cathartic and liberating.
Yeah, I think there is this sense of stoicism as being sort of not just emotionlessness, but sort of being able to be unaffected by the things that have happened to a person, which is probably possible for minor things, but I'm not sure a person can spend 30 years of their life with a stutter, let's say, and that not take a toll on them, that you not accumulate pain and frustration and resentments and, sort of debts, right, between you and other people, between you and society, between you and yourself, that if you, eventually that bill comes due, I would guess, right? And it's there's interest accruing on it the longer you pretend it's not there.
That's why I love that Marcus Aurelius quote so much that I put in the epigraph: the impediment to action advances action, what stands in the way becomes the way. Because he's not saying the impediment is no big deal.
Right. Yes.
He's saying the impediment is interwoven to your existence.
When you think about, he's not saying, although actually the irony is in that quote, he's referring to people who get in our way, right? The specificity of that quote is he's like, when people get in our way. But I think generally when you look at his life, it's a life filled with overwhelming tragedy. He loses his father early on. His sort of plan to be a contemplative philosopher is disrupted. He becomes emperor. It's 20 years of pandemics and wars and coups and, stuff. He loses 6 children before they come into adulthood. It's devastating tragedy after tragedy, for him to be a guy who could get out of bed in the morning and say, the impediment to action advances action, what stands in the way becomes the way. Yeah, you know, he wasn't talking about traffic, you know, he was talking about the heartbreaking devastation that life can inflict on a person.
Absolutely. And to be sure, I am a very, very, very lucky, fortunate person. You know, I'm married, I have a great family, great friends, gainfully employed. I have so much to be thankful for, and so many things that just put me in a luckier, more privileged position than the overwhelming majority of the world's population. And that is sure. Never lost on me at any moment. And the only thing I'm trying to get across in this book is my personal experience with a daily problem can be applied to many other people's daily problems. And I'm hoping that this book and the other people in it and the wisdom I've received from other people gives you a roadmap for not curing your problem, but for just making peace with your problem.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, with what we were just talking about, right? One could have a stutter and cancer. One could have a stutter and lose their parents and have all their money stolen from them, right? I mean, like, it can always be worse. That's not always super comforting, but like, it is easy because our problems are our problems and they're all we know. And that's not to dismiss the reality or the severity of our problems either, right? But like, it's so easy to go to this is the worst thing that could have possibly happened, when the reality, it's not even close.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, in the course of writing this book, my wife and I live above a bagel shop in New York City. And there are these two big industrial exhaust fans out behind our bedroom window. And they click on every morning at 5 a.m., which means that the people downstairs making the bagels have probably already been there for an hour, and they probably woke up an hour and a half before that, and probably took two trains and buses to get here. And all I have to do is wake up and write some sentences. And that daily reminder was just the best thing in the world.
Yeah, yeah. It's when you can step back and realize how many people would gladly trade places with you, mm-hmm. it can sort of cut off the spiral or the pity party before it gets too out of control. Again, it doesn't mean it's awesome to be you, right? Like, I mean this generally, I'm not saying you specifically, like just because someone would trade places with you doesn't mean you're a king on earth. It just means, you know, before you think that, you know, you're at the absolute bottom of the pile, or that the world has particularly singled you out for misfortune, it's always good to remember like how many people would die for like 10 seconds of your life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Or that even you yourself, I imagine when you were 11 years old, imagining, one, doing this interview, two, you know, writing the articles you've done, having the job you've had. You tell the story in the book about going on, you know, your first live television hit. I imagine a lot of the things that you've ended up doing in your life were almost inconceivable to you at one point or another, right?
Ryan, I can't even imagine doing this interview when I was 29 years old. It's turned my whole life around, facing this problem and facing it publicly. And it's made every relationship in my life better. And it's made me a more comfortable person.
Well, circling back to writing, you're both a writer and an editor. I can see how it would make one a better writer, because you're sort of really having to think about what I think about this. I was curious, though, do you think it's made you a better editor also? And how so?
Yes. And this gets back to what I mentioned earlier about being acutely conscious of not taking up too much of the reader's time and trying to keep them engaged. I like to think of my writing and editing, which go hand in hand. I think of it like a bonsai tree, and you're just always trying to make that cut. When I was writing this, every night my wife, who is total saint, would come in and read that day's pages to me out loud. And the reason my wife did this is because even when I'm alone, if I'm the only person in this small room reading out loud, I will still stutter. And that gets down to the neurological element. It's not because I'm nervous. I'm here alone. I'm not anxious, but it's a neurological disorder. Right. I will still stutter. And the key to good writing is rhythm, momentum. And it upsets me that I can't read my work aloud and maintain that momentum and rhythm. So my wife would read it out loud to me, and I would close my eyes and I would say, okay, like, we got to cut that adjective, we got to cut that adverb, that two syllable word should get down to a one syllable word. Just cut, and get it down to its purest essence. And that's a technique I think anybody can use at any time to try to make a piece of writing better.
Yeah, I can imagine, and it probably forces you to be both very understanding, but then also very strict with the people whose writing you edit, because you're not going to put up with indulgent or flowery or, you know, poorly written stuff, because you sort of have an economy and a sense of importance on language. And then also, though, you're probably quite empathetic to the idea, which I was thinking about because you talk about in the book, it's like you were like the struggle of like not being able to articulate, to say what you think. That's also inherently the struggle of writing. Like I could speak fine, but it's never on the page what I want it to be. If it was, I would be the greatest writer in the world, right? Nobody in the we know what we want to do, right? We have this sort of sense of what we want the writing to be. It's the fucking doing it that's so hard, and it's never as good as you want it to be. So I imagine you have a unique sort of empathy for that and an ability to get someone from A to B.
Yes, absolutely. And that reality that you just articulated is the case for literally every writer. You know, even people like Michael Lewis, there's this great quote, I wish I had in front of me, but he told an interviewer once, he said, my writing process is sweaty and inelegant. And yeah. I think he said, you know, paraphrasing here, so I mean, I got exactly right, but I think he said that he rewrites every chapter something like 20 times, just trying to get it down to the pure essence. And when you think of Michael Lewis, Big Short, Moneyball, all these blockbuster nonfiction books, the overarching quality of his work is clarity, concision, kind of above anybody else. And it's reassuring to learn that it can take him 20 times to get there.
Yeah, or the Hemingway line, the first draft of anything is shit. And that we're all struggling with the gap between what we're trying to say and what we're able to say.
Yes, and that gap is pronounced when you're a person who stutters.
Well, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Good.
No, I was just going to say, as we're wrapping up, because this conversation has been awesome. I was thinking about your piece on Biden, which I found to be beautiful and moving. Just as I found it when they did the virtual convention and they had that little boy with a stutter do a talk. I was curious as after I've read that and I've thought like it. It's interesting that someone who is so well known, who's been in the public eye for so long, and maybe this goes to why having a stutter is so hard, and your point about never having realized there were resources to help you get along in a world not designed for that. It seems like it's just totally taken for granted that this guy had a stutter and is past it, and that's fundamentally not how it works.
If you're a kid who stutters, and I mean, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old, there is a window in which you can retrain your brain to, you know, for lack of a better word, cure your stutter. This can happen with therapy, or it can happen naturally. And 75% of all kids who stutter won't have the problem as adults. But for about 25%, they will continue to stutter for the rest of their lives. And the best you can do if you fall into that category is learn to manage it. Biden continued to stutter through high school and college, you know, well past the point of a little kid, but became very adept at managing it. And for the bulk of his political career, he managed it. But if you go back and you watch old addresses and old, you know, old things, you can see the manifestations of it still, the coping mechanisms. And what I found and what other people who stutter found, adults, what researchers, academics, therapists, was as Biden reached this later point in his life, he just turned 80, as he was getting older and older, he simply became less adept at managing the stutter, which, you know, you look at anyone, you look at Bill Clinton now compared to the way Bill Clinton sounded in the mid-90s. They don't sound exactly the same. It doesn't mean that either of them have dementia. It's just the reality of aging. And so
that's what I was thinking about. It's like we're so quick to reduce or be worried about or criticize what seems like, the mark of a slowing down 80-year-old. And it struck me, sort of thinking about it through the lens of your work, is like, this dude must be tired, like just tired. His brain and his body must be tired in the way that I'm sure John McCain's arm was tired. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you find a way to compensate or mitigate the injury done to you that was not your fault. But as you get older, like the idea that you're going to be able to continue to keep that up the same way is unlikely. And it feels like we're doing a bad job having empathy for that and trying to ascribe to it some sort of unfitness instead of saying, oh, I can very easily meet you halfway on that.
Mm-hmm. And to be sure, having a stutter is not a get out of jail free card. It doesn't explain everything. This is not a one size fits all answer. There are plenty of moments in which Joe Biden mixes up a name or a fact, and those moments have nothing to do with being a person who stutters. But there are other moments in which he clearly exhibits the secondary behaviors that are associated with stuttering, like loss of eye contact, rapid blinks, down to very visible things like moving his mouth. Like sometimes you'll see him go like, you know, and that has nothing to do with getting old. Those are manifestations of a stutter, and he actively manages it still, but just not in the same way. I think he managed it around the age of 40. But what you said is really important, because it all comes down to our society's lack of understanding, lack of interest, lack of nuance when it comes to disability.
Yeah, and realizing that just thinking about it through the lens of your work, and I think he's a pretty good president. There's things I very much disagree with him on, and things I do agree with him on. But I was thinking about it in terms of like you're saying, like, hey, I don't want to sign up for this speech class, and I may well drop out of college, because it's in some ways easier than the ordeal that I'm, you know, dreading. And you're like, this guy has the most public job in the entire world, the job that demands the most verbal acuity, the most sort of quickness on your feet, the most preciseness in your language. And the fact that he's doing even a half decent job communicating, that he could get up on a debate stage and go toe to toe with a person who's, I won't say bright, but certainly good on television, right? In all of human history are sort of tales of people who have had stutters. I mean, it kind of ranks up there with the Demosthenes or whomever, right? Like that he could do it at any level, given what he's been through. I'm not sure we appropriately credit or acknowledge just what a feat of strength and skill that must be. And fortitude.
And Biden, as a kid, adopted the Demosthenes method, where he put pebbles in his mouth.
Yeah,
it's pretty wild the way all of these things are interwoven.
And it's a beautiful story, and I thought your piece was amazing, and I thought this book was amazing, and I was so glad to see Marcus at the beginning, and I hope that the story it inspires people, and it was absolutely awesome talking with you, and I can only imagine how stressful and difficult the press and book tour has been. But I hope you give yourself credit. As you said, if you couldn't even have comprehended doing this interview a few years ago, I hope it's really striking you just what you're pulling off here, because you did awesome, and the book is great too.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to talk with you. I'm a big fan of your work, and I appreciate all the positivity that you put out there on the internet. Because, you know, like I said, I'll be looking at Instagram and feeling bad about myself, and then I'll see your post or a Daily Stoic post, and I'll be like, all right, here we go. And it kind of resets me. But thank you very much. I really appreciate everything.
Awesome. I hope everyone checks out the book. It's really good. Life on Delay, Making Peace with a Stutter by John Hendrickson. John, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V, Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.